This is North Shore Today. It is Wednesday, 24th day of February. Hi, everyone. I'm Bill Newell. It's a wet Wednesday. Along with Rick Moore, we're here to discuss some of the news of the day. Our guests include, we have Bill Hamilton, who is a professor at Salem State University, who is running a course, or several courses, actually, on sustainable beekeeping. We do have a complete post of that up on our website, but you'll hear that interview today on our program with Bill Hamilton. We also have a video with Mike Carr, the winning basketball coach last night from Lynn English High School. They defeated Beverly by 3 points. And we do have a separate post on that game as well. And we also have, although the latest results are in from the Nevada caucuses last night where Donald Trump wins again, but we do have Seth Meyers analyzing the South Carolina primary from last weekend from the Late Show. So we've got a few couple of videos up there. And, of course, again, Bill Hamilton will be joining us. So, Rick, let's get into some of our news stories. Do you want to start in the Gloucester area?
Yeah, the Gloucester Times has a story again on the payroll problem that took place when a company, a payroll company, supposedly was paying taxes for businesses and towns in the area, but never paid the state taxes, and so the town of Essex allegedly owed $380,000 to the Internal Revenue Service that the town thought it had paid. But the payroll company, you know, had held onto the funds. So anyway, they're waiving some of the money, so the town only has to pay $212,000 now that it will take out of its rainy day fund, I guess, to pay it to the state and to the Internal Revenue Service. I guess it's both state and federal taxes. But it is suing that payroll company to recoup the money that it has to pay, obviously. And what I can't find in the article is who's paying that extra $168,000 if, in fact, the payroll company is being sued by the IRS, or how that works, because, you know, you look at it and you say, okay, Essex gets a break there, but on the other hand, that's taxes, you know, that is owed by somebody that isn't being collected, so I'm not sure. We'll have to see if there's a follow-up on that. The other thing is...
We're paying for it, Rick. That's who's paying
well,
for it,
right?
Well,
that's the point. Yeah, that's the whole point, and that's my thing is, you know, we have to pay our share, so... you know, Essex got screwed, but somebody should, you know, that payroll company, I'm guessing, will end up paying for it some way, shape, or form. Sean Horgan also has a story in the Gloucester Times that there was a meeting of the State Economic Council in Gloucester yesterday in which the state announced that Gloucester was getting $151,000 from the state to help promote its Seafood Expo. Visit. They're going to have $150,000 to run ads and buy space on billboards. Wish we had that kind of money, Bill.
Yeah.
And Nahant will be getting $410,000 to reconstruct and stabilize its town wharf.
Yeah, the item actually had that story today. Apparently, there's some seawall work and the boat ramp that needs to be done at Tudor Wharf in Nahant, their one wharf. Like that, Gloucester has a bunch of them, don't they? We must have a bunch of, yeah. So
several, yeah. Many, as a matter of fact, and many public ramps and launches as well. Yeah, they're Gloucester everywhere,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that 400,000 or 400,000 plus is mentioned in today's Lynn item as well. Also in the item today on the front page in some political news, State Representative Donald Wong out of Saugus, his district includes Saugus, a little part of Lynn and part of Wakefield as well. It's the 9th Essex District. Well, he's announcing that he's seeking re-election to the seat, so that's not a huge surprise there. Here's another story, Rick, that is kind of of interest. Obviously, we've been following the opioid problem, but the Lynn City Council was given a Narcan training session and update on heroin issues in the city as part of a meeting on Tuesday night. And Lynn Police Chief Kevin Coppinger was one of the presenters in that session on Tuesday night. You know, also, Rick, I saw a story where on TV this weekend, I think it was, and it was out of Manchester, New Hampshire, and they had an incredible number of overdose cases in that city, which is no surprise because, I mean, it's been a major problem and a major issue up in New Hampshire, as it is here in Essex County and in the North Shore and beyond and around the country. But the number was really staggering, like 40 in over a weekend of overdose cases. Just incredible. And really taxing on the emergency response units.
I saw somebody somewhere on television, some interview or some program, and I just caught a glimpse of it, but And actually, the opioid overdose problem seems to be getting bigger, and it's even worse than I think some of the media is portraying. And that is that's really an eye opener. I agree with you, Bill. It's really scary.
And here's a here's yet another story here. So here we are. We're concerned about the opioid problem in relationship to heroin. Yet, medical marijuana dispensaries will eventually be coming to Lynn. This is a story, front page story on the item by Gail Colley. And according to the current city zoning ordinance, it is written there is no location for where they could be implemented. But apparently they are going to be coming to the city, Lynn. Let me just read a little bit further here. The way the current ordinance is written, there is no conceivable location in the city of Lynn where the medical marijuana facility could be located, said City Council President Dan Cahill. Cahill said the Attorney General's office has opined that such exclusionary ordinances are effectively unconstitutional and therefore would not be upheld if challenged in court. So Cahill and the City Council, Mayor's Office, Lynn Department of Economic Development team, Lynn Police, are looking towards redrafting an acceptable medical marijuana ordinance that protects the residents in areas and property locates potential dispensaries away from the schools. So I guess the medical marijuana are on the council's agenda. Maybe that's a better way of describing it. Not that they're coming to Lynn, but they're on the council's agenda. How about that? So.
And I've changed my opinion about marijuana over the years. I've never done it. When I was in the army, my driver and my assistant driver on my I had a 105 millimeter howitzer crew I was a section chief of, and they indulged. I never did, never have, but I know a lot of people do, and my opinion of pot over the years has changed. So I think I think there still needs to be more research done on it and so on, but I don't think it's as bad as I once did.
All right, now the other story we talked about, Rick, a few days ago, and well, the last few days as well. This is was a front page story in the Salem News. Excuse me, I apologize. Regarding Latino voters in the city of Salem, I think they had a story Saturday. They had another story on Tuesday, and now there's a the mayor has signed something just yesterday regarding. Some new policies in that direction to address the concerns of the Salem Latino voters. But also the city clerk of Salem, Cheryl LaPointe, has penned a letter to the editor in which she kind of defends the practices. And she outlines in her letter the number of kind of bilingual kind of practices that they have put forward. And so I think they're kind of pushing back on the stories that were in the Salem News as far as kind of being, how do I want to say it, not empathetic, but culturally responsive to Latino voters in Salem. The articles clearly were critical of the Salem practices in those regards. So,
well, I hope to be talking with the Salem mayor soon. Next week we have a planned visit. We'll see if that pans out. And then we'll ask her to comment on it. She always has... A particularly good way of explaining things is the way I'll put it. We'll see if the mayor has a comment on that, and she might not. I don't know, but I'll ask. Bill, I want to talk about a story. I saw it on Discovery. I have a Discovery app, Discovery News, and each day I check it out for the latest science news. And did you see the story where some Apollo astronauts heard some strange music when they went around the moon, the Apollo 10 astronauts?
Yeah.
It wasn't music. They heard some strange interference on their radio. And it's interesting that a couple of other Apollo astronauts mentioned the same thing. There's been some weird stuff coming out of the archives from the Apollo missions. And one of the later astronauts who went to the moon said if there's something that they heard on tape or around the moon, then there's something there. And then very quickly, within 24 hours, there came a statement out of NASA by another Apollo astronaut who said he had been told before he went on an Apollo mission to the moon, he had been told by engineers that there's some kind of interference when they go around the moon. There's something within the communication systems of the Apollo spacecraft itself that gets a little weird. And so he said he heard the same noises, but he was expecting it because of what the radio technicians have told him. And I love the way that this all turns into a conspiracy, it turns into alien or whatever it might be. But it is interesting, the questions that are unanswered, and then how quickly there is a response to deny it. But someday I will tell you and the public an Alan Shepard story that I was told by his nephew one time. And it has to do with Shepard spotting artifacts on the moon or something. And the implication is that perhaps another country actually made it to the moon before the United States did, but it was a secret mission. And that, of course, they point to Nazi Germany and the rockets there. So kind of an interesting story, but, you know, there's not a whole lot of basis to it. It just makes for some headlines, I guess.
I don't know if we talked about this, Rick. You just brought up Nazi Germany, so I'll try to keep this within 30 seconds. But there was a show on TV, might have been over the holidays or the end of last year, is on one of those learning channels, Smithsonian Channel. Well, I'm not sure which one it was, but it was Hunting Hitler, I think it was. And so I ended up watching one of them, and it was a very interesting show, and it seemed very compelling. Basically, they're making the case that Hitler not survived Germany and went to, say, Argentina, went to South America, and they made a number of cases for that. I actually looked at my DVR the other day, and they're still there. I haven't had a chance to watch them, but it seemed very interesting, and it seemed like there clearly was a Nazi influence down in that area in Argentina. So, you know, it just all these little things going on, and it's just surprised that we didn't. In fact, this was months ago, that we really just don't know the truth, or maybe these are all just fabrications. Who knows? But I don't know. What do you think? Maybe they're picking up another radio station from the other side of the moon. That's the way I kind of heard it described to me, that it was kind of some kind of, once you get on the other side of the moon, you might be picking up other signals or whatever.
I don't know, because it's a contained spacecraft, and their only communication in that time was a direct line of sight back to Earth. There were no satellites around the moon at that time. So I don't know. It's kind of weird. I'd like to hear more about it. It doesn't make any sense that they wouldn't hear that, that they would only hear it on the other side, you know, when they were blocked from Earth signals on the one hand. But on the other hand, maybe that interference is there all the time. But when they get back in view of direct line-of-sight radio signals, it's sort of muted by the regular signals. So, yeah, I think it requires a little more study or a little more articles coming out from somebody. And with respect to what happened after World War II, let's remember that the, our German scientists beat Russia's German scientists to the moon. But all of that was very secretive when Wernher von Braun and his crew defected to the United States or surrendered to the United States after the war. And the fact that he was a Nazi was kept under wraps for at least 20 years. That didn't come out till many, many years, probably in the 1970s, 25 years after the war, that von Braun himself had been a Nazi.
Well, coming up, we have Bill Hamilton. He is the professor at Salem State University. Rick got a chance to go up to West Newbury yesterday. We have a separate post up on this. He's teaching a class at Salem State on sustainable beekeeping. So I learned about that. We get a little video tour of his farm up there. So he's a full-time professor, but he also has this beekeeping farm, if you will. And it's very interesting. I remember the story. So there's some information in the interview. Remember a few years ago, there was a bunch of very serious stories out there, and legitimately so, about the number of bees decreasing in the country. Well, it's a little tricky sustaining bees and beehives and the role that bees play in all the pollination for food and so on, for plants, vegetables, and so on. So anyway, this guy is really an interesting guy, and he really has carved out kind of a scientific niche for himself, but yet a very valuable one, and something that, you know, what's interesting in our day-to-day busy lives is sometimes things around us are a blur, but then you have this individual that's so focused on really doing, you know, some really good work in this area. And anyways, you listen to the interview coming up, you'll hear from Bill Hamilton and, the role that he is, helping out other people with the course in creating sustainable beekeeping in our area.
Well, I'm glad somebody does it, because when I go to the Topsfield Fair, we have to go to the bee barn there and get candles and get the honey and stuff. But I have to walk right by, you know, the demonstration where they got the glass and they show all the bees, you know, in the glass case. I have to walk by that and close my eyes. It just absolutely freaks me out. So, you know, good luck to people who can do that and can handle that. Now, were the bees asleep, Bill? Did you see any?
No, I did not see any bees. I saw a warning sign for a bee, you know, that there could be bees, but they... You know, apparently, and we talk about this. I think we talk about this in the interview, but I'm pretty sure, unless we talked about it before the interview. But for example, last winter, with all the snow and cold, you know, the bees form this kind of a bubble around themselves, this hive, and you know, some of the ones on the outside may die off, but there's so many on the inside that they do live, but they do have to go out and in and out of the hive during the winter, so they do, but they just don't go out in big numbers. So no, I did not see a bee, but in the kind of weather that we had, for example, yesterday, what, we were around 40 degrees, I'm thinking, kind of a chilly 40, but a 40 damn 40 degrees, but it was no, I didn't see any bees, but it's not to say that they wouldn't be coming in and out at this time of year, to be honest. From what I understand, yeah.
Okay.
They definitely do shut way down in the wintertime, you know, but on the other hand, it's not that they don't. That some bee will not go out, is from what I understand, during the winter.
Sort of like me as a retired teacher.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we'll take a quick check of sports just a moment here. Stay with us here on North Shore Today.
This is MSO, newsports.com. We're joined by Bill Hamilton, professor, Salem State University, and we're talking bees, but welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for allowing us to check this out here. But you're going to be offering a class or course, several courses on beekeeping, and tell us a little bit about that, how that works, and then your background, I guess, as well.
Well, there are a lot of bee schools in Massachusetts, and they're all successful. But what we've done is we've done something a little bit different. We're offering a 3-course sequence. First one goes from March into April to get people up and running, installing their bees. The next one is in June. Talk about summer management, pest predators of diseases. How do you take care of those pests? The third one is in August, which is basically getting the bees ready for winter, requeening. And then we have a short course on sustainable beekeeping, which is raising queens and making splits, splitting your hives to get more hives.
Now, beekeeping, let's say in Essex County, how big is beekeeping in Essex County?
It's fairly popular in Essex County. Essex County Beekeepers Association is a very good organization, has lots of members, would like to have a lot more members in it. They run a school. There's a school at New England Bees. They're in Acton, I think, is one of their schools. So there are plenty of schools around. People, lots and lots of people interested in it. There's a place in Peabody, Crystal Bee Supply has got a school running. So there's a lot of activity.
All right. Now, why do people get into this? Is it just for the honey?
Well, it's...
I mean, are they like bears?
Well, you know, it's always... the first question I get is, do you get stung a lot? And then what about the honey? I think a lot of people saw this back to nature. They've heard the bees are in trouble. They want to do something about the pollinators. There's sort of this... you know, strange interest is I'm keeping an animal that stings and yet I can manipulate it. And there's a lot to it. And they're interested. Again, it's sort of a back to nature kind of movement and something that doesn't take it's not like a horse, doesn't take a big footprint in your yard. But it is, you have to know what you're doing. It is a little time intensive.
Now, when I think of beekeeping, I'm thinking Topsfield Fair. I'm thinking, you know, up in the more rural areas of Essex County. But if you were in a residential neighborhood, say in West Peabody, you can't. Can you do bees in an area like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The towns have ordinances, but Beverly, Mass. Got a high population of beekeepers. Salem, people keep them on their porch. In Boston, they're on the roofs. In Cambridge, they're everywhere. You're not going to have 100 hives. I don't think most people want 100 hives. But again, because they take up a small footprint, and as long as you cite them correctly and you're listening to the ordinances of the town, they're usually not a problem.
I guess they're not loud or anything like some animals could be in the like roosters or whatever. Yeah.
No, you know, if you never tell anyone they're there, they're really not there. The only time someone might notice is if the hive swarms. But a swarm literally lasts 15 minutes. So you'd have to be there to see it. Other than that, you never see what happens. Right.
Let's talk about your course, because one of the things we talked about before we started was fail points in other courses or fail points for people that that want to become beekeepers. So tell me about that, your thinking on that, having been in this and teaching this for almost 40 years, right?
Right. Well, the most courses will offer, you'll offer a program from February to April. You'll get the people, they'll order their bees, they'll put their equipment together, and they'll put the bees in. And then a lot of them have mentoring programs, which is a good way to go. But people don't want to bother other people. The other problem is that people don't understand that you have to open the hive. Just because there's bees moving in and out of the hive doesn't mean the hive is healthy. And so what we decided to do at the university was basically through the Enterprise Center is to create a course which gets you through the mechanics of getting your hive ready, siting it, putting the bees in, letting you go off, and then they can always call me, always talk to me. But then another course in June, a very short course, 3 or 4 weeks, which basically says, let's take a look at your hive. Let's see what's going to happen now throughout the summer. Let's make sure the bees are doing okay. And then we have another one in August. And August is really the beginning of the beekeeper's year. It's not April. It's you're getting ready to get them through the winter. And that's when we have to check the queen for requeening. That's the time we have to start feeding them if they need to be fed to get them through through the winter. If we have to do any kind of pesticide control or mite control on them, that's the time to do it. That's a very laborious time. And again, if you're not sure of those steps, there's a lot of things going on there. The hive's not going to make it through the winter.
What is requeening? What is that?
Well, you know, the queen is the, basically the head of the entire hive.
And or can we talk about that?
No,
I don't know.
No, we can. But I mean, the bottom line is when the queen starts to fail, two things are going to happen. And there's a very famous in beekeeping, the queen must die. Eventually, the queen's going to fail. She's not going to be laying the 1,200 eggs a day. The other bees are going to notice, and they're going to make a new queen. And eventually, they're going to get rid of the old queen. In modern beekeeping, if we see any evidence that the queen is failing, rather than have them go through that process, we take a new queen and install it in the hive so that the hive always has a formidable queen. What you want in winter and what you want in all hives is a very strong bee population, a very healthy bee population. If you have that, they can withstand almost anything.
Now, does this queen, because we talked before also about ordering the bees, and is that a queen has to be ordered or identified within the bees you already have?
No. Most people will buy a queen from a bee supplier, or they'll order them from California or the South, and they'll order the type, the race of queen they want. It arrives, comes in a cage, you install it. And literally, within as soon as she starts laying, the entire hive is now under her control. What we try to do, and it can be a fairly expensive proposition if you have a lot of hives, what we're trying to do with our course is to show people how to be sustainable, to raise your own queens so that you have a supply of your own queens, you put them in. If one fails, you know, if you buy a queen from Georgia and it's perfectly good queen, but you put it in and for some reason it fails, you have to go buy another queen. And another week goes by or a few days go by. So if you learn how to do these things, they're not difficult. They can be a little bit time-consuming, but they're not difficult. But it's a money saver and it ensures that you have strong hives.
Yeah. Now, you're into the – you obviously can talk about maintaining hives and so on. How much are you into the, say, the honey piece of it? In other words, is that just a product that, you know, do you get into that piece of it at all?
Oh, yeah. No. In the course, we will show you in the, I believe it's the August course, we show you how to extract honey, how to extract it correctly, the bottling procedures. You know, we talk about if you want to market your honey, how you sell the honey, so on and so forth, how not to ruin the honey. A lot of people overheat honey and ruin it. We talk about other products, wax, how do you get wax out of the hive, how to get pollen out of the hive, pollen products, so that, you know, if you're into this stuff and you want to have pollen on your cereal, you want to have honey, how to make not just a god-awful mess out of everything, because it is a tricky business, a sticky business as well.
Let me ask you this, though. In your meal planning or diet, I mean, how much honey, I mean, and what kind of recipes and stuff are you using in your own, say, personal life? Or can't you stand honey?
Oh, no, I like honey. No, I have honey every day. We use honey all the time. My wife and my daughter are vegans, so they cut down on the sugar aspect. And actually, in vegans, honey isn't allowed, but they cheat. But we use honey all the time. We use it instead of sugar.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are obvious health advantages to that piece as well, aren't there, I believe?
Well, the raw honey will contain pollen, and people that have allergies, you can get desensitized over a long period of time with the honey. The honey, if it's made correctly, the enzymes in it are again another health benefit if you process it correctly. So it's good stuff.
Yeah. How about you? We also talked about at one point the fact that bees were in danger. What's the update on that? Because that was a serious issue. At least it came out a number of years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago. Certainly a huge story.
Yeah, I know. They're still the bee population is still in trouble. We used to have 6 million hives. We're down to a little under 2 million across the United States. Interestingly enough, we have never produced enough honey in this country. We've always imported at least 50% of our national needs. So right now, it's not so much the honey as it is pollination of the crops. We don't have enough bees to pollinate the crops correctly. And part of that has to do with the varroa mite that's destroying the colonies and the amount of work it now takes to be a beekeeper. It's much different than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
All right. If you were to add on anything else, what haven't I asked you about that you think is important that we haven't really talked about here, either about the course or the whole kind of industry, so to speak, or hobby of beekeeping?
Well, I think the industry is starting to change. The commercial beekeeping, everyone has to modify their protocols in keeping bees. I think the most important thing is people that want to keep bees have to understand that these aren't puppies. You have to be out there when you have to be out there to take care of them. As long as you do that, you'll be relatively successful in keeping the bees.
All right, I got it. So this wasn't a rough winter for us this year, but tell me about what does it mean to be a bee in Essex County in the wintertime? I just can't even, it's one of those things that just go completely off the radar screen for most of us because we don't see, you don't see a mosquito, you don't see flies, and you don't see bees either. What happens?
Well, in the winter, what happens is the bees form a cluster, and the queen's pretty much in the center. And they maintain the hive around 93 to 95 degrees all winter long by vibrating their flight muscles, which is why they need about anywhere from 60 to 100 pounds of honey themselves to maintain their energy. And the outer shell of that cluster will slowly die off. The idea is to have enough bees so the queen and there's enough bees left in the spring to start. As a matter of fact, it's the end of February. She's going to start laying. The sunlight is the days are getting longer, and she'll start laying eggs here fairly soon. The big thing around here is that bees will not defecate in a hive, so they have to have flights. And this winter has been very good because the bees have been able to fly out. Last winter, some hives died because the bees could not leave the hive. So this has been a pretty good winter.
That makes sense. All right, Bill Hamilton, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for all this information.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bill Hamilton from Salem State on the beekeeper course that you'll see more details posted below on our website on msonewsports.com.
Well, in sports, we got a post up there with a lot of results from yesterday. We've got boys basketball where Everett defeated Lynn Classical. We had the Lynn English Beverly results for you. Beverly girls won. They qualified for the tournament. Marblehead girls pulled off a big win at Everett last night. But we got all the scores up on the website from the earlier post. Plus, we got some post-game comments from Lynn English High School last night from Coach Scott Lewis of Beverly and, of course, Mike Carr from Lynn English High School, which we also have on this post here today on North Shore Today, and a couple of video clips of the final moments of the game last night at Lynn English High School. So we've got that. And I did notice that it looks like the boys basketball team is playing at Peabody tonight while the Danvers girls are hosting Peabody tonight. Yeah, I got that right. So games are winding way down here, light schedule here as we're coming down to the end of the regular season.
Yeah, and just one more hockey game left each for Gloucester and for Marblehead. Gloucester and Marblehead each playing Somerville, although not at the same time. Gloucester plays Somerville tonight, and Somerville will be playing Marblehead on Friday.
Yeah, and I saw where Newburyport is taking on St. John's Prep in hockey. I believe that's tonight as well. And
Newburyport's had a really, really tough schedule in Division One, and they've done very well.
David Ortiz got to training camp, and he.
Oh, geez, here we go.
Here we go, Rick.
7 months of this.
I know. Day one of the Ortiz farewell tour. But
God.
But anyways, I guess he held court for over a half hour talked about a number of different things. But David Ortiz back for his final year with the Red Sox. So there we go. We got Andy Carbone's on the website as well. Our baseball insider, Andy, has some sharp criticism in a few areas for the Red Sox. But David Price seems to be a good addition and so on. So pitching may be less of a problem this year. Although I'm still curious about their other starters. You got Price, but who else you got? And so we'll see. But that's for another day.
Yep.
And so for this day, we'll put the wraps on North Shore today on this Wednesday, 24th day of February, with Rick Bohr. I'm Bill Newell on MSONewsSports.com.